You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The Indigenous Environmental Network brought over 20 Indigenous delegates from Native communities in Canada and the U.S. to participate in advocacy and demonstrations in the recent climate summit in Copenhagen. The Canadian government was a particular target in the efforts of climate advocates, drawing fire from many quarters for its backwards policy on emissions targets. Clayton Thomas Mueller is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network based in Ottawa. He was in Copenhagen, and he joins us to discuss Indigenous demands and to assess the results of the conference. Hello, Clayton.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. So why were the tar sands at the top of the list of your concerns in Copenhagen?
Well, I think that, the Canada's tar sands development represents probably one of the largest new sources of emissions globally. We're talking about a development that makes the pyramids of Giza look like Lego blocks, that makes the Great Wall of China look like a white picket fence in terms of the scale, the sheer size of this development. Already, the provincial government of Alberta, in partnership with Big Oil, has already deforested an area of the boreal forest in northern Alberta, the size of the country of Greece. And of course, the boreal forest is a critical carbon sink in terms of the global climate crisis. And so this development, on so many levels, represents just such a backwards direction that the Canadian government, in partnership with Big Oil, is taking. And that's why, at the international climate negotiations, the government of Canada really essentially emerged as the Darth Vader of the negotiations and was working with, who we all know as the Emperor, the United States government, to try and systematically kill any kind of legally binding framework coming out of the conference, which they were successful at achieving. And so for us, as Indigenous peoples, we are on the front lines of, Canadian and United States energy policy in terms of the bearing the brunt of the impacts of the development that is being built on the backs of our communities to provide cheap energy for unsustainable cities across Turtle Island. And so we brought many frontline voices from communities fighting big coal, fighting the tar sands in northern Alberta, fighting against the massive pipeline and oil refinery infrastructure that's spiraling out of the province of Alberta across the continental North America, to, shame Canada, to shame the United States, and to, shed light on the grave human rights violations that are occurring in our own backyard in terms of the global climate crisis and backwards energy policy.
Now, what environmental impacts do First Nations people face in the area where the tar sands are being developed?
Well, for the listeners that don't know, the tar sands development, widely publicized in the media, is the most energy and water intensive development ever in the history of mankind. For every barrel of oil produced in Canada's tar sands, it requires 5 barrels of pristine water, typically sourced from the Athabasca watershed, a critical lifeway, waterway that many Indigenous communities, both Cree, Dene, and Métis, rely on for transportation, for subsistence through fishing and hunting. Since the tar sands development has ramped up over the last 10 years, they've seen the Athabasca River, which is already impacted by climate change. It's a glacier-fed river, and the glaciers feeding the Athabasca River are disappearing as a result of climate change. And the river itself is even more stressed because of the tremendous uptake that industry does to process tar sands crude. And the other factor to think about as well is that every single day in Canada's tar sands, they move enough earth to fill the Rogers Sky Dome in Toronto. There's a tremendous amount of, I think it's 4 tons of earth for every barrel of oil they produce. And so, they use the world's largest trucks, the world's largest earth movers for this project, And, you know, the whole while they're tearing up boreal forest, a critical, biosystem that indigenous peoples have relied on, you know, not just for food, but also for their sacred connection to Mother Earth through their cultural practices, for time immemorial. And just in the last few years, we've seen, you know, all kinds of socioeconomic problems emerge in downstream communities, First Nations communities, and non-Native communities in Canada's tar sands as a result of this development, as a result of the influx of 75,000 workers, primarily non-Native, coming into isolated rural northern Alberta, which creates all kinds of social problems. We've seen, you know, a tremendous spike in the amount of rare forms of cancers and autoimmune deficiency syndromes amongst local Native populations because of, you know, a process of bioaccumulation. You know, when you eat from the land, you know, you get what is coming from the land. And in northern Alberta, because of the tar sands, that ends up being a whole bunch of toxins, everything from polyaromatic cyclic hydrocarbons to, you know, different kinds of heavy metals, arsenic, mercury, all coming from, you know, the great disturbance that over 22 oil companies are bringing to that territory.
Now I understand that a gift basket was given to the Prime Minister by Indigenous representatives as a gesture of hospitality and as an act of solidarity with communities directly impacted by the tar sands. What was in the basket?
Well, we thought that it would be, you know, Prime Minister Harper, as we've all seen, you know, has a serious issue with running a democratic country or obeying any kind of international treaties, including, you know, the many Indian treaties that the federal government of Canada has yet to honor. And so we thought that we would help remind Prime Minister Harper upon his arrival to Copenhagen. We organized a direct action at the Canadian Embassy in Copenhagen on December 13th, where hundreds of people, unfurled a massive banner in front of the embassy that stated, you know, "Hey Harper, tar sands is not in the climate deal. Respect First Nations rights now." And we presented we unfurled a welcome mat in front of the embassy, a big welcome mat, and presented a representative of the embassy with a very beautiful basket full of every single Indian treaty here in Canada, as well as the Kyoto Protocol. And I think most importantly, a copy of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Because a very significant part of our message in Copenhagen was that, you know, the main reason that Canada has not adhered and fulfilled its commitments to the Kyoto Protocol and why it was trying to systematically kill any kind of legally binding framework coming out of Copenhagen is the same reason why it still has not ratified the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Because if they respect Indigenous peoples' right to self-determination, to free, prior, informed consent, and all of the articles within the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, things like the tar sands are not possible, bottom line.
Why is that? Why would the tar sands not be possible if they respected the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples?
Well, if Canada respected Aboriginal people's rights to say no to harmful developments in their backyards, then, you know, bottom line, things like tar sands wouldn't be possible. It's pretty simple, you know. And I think that these two, you know, Canada's economic policy, you know, how Canada has been approaching, climate policy, is inextricably linked with its dysfunctional relationship with its largest trading partner, the United States, which of course is the primary receiver of tar sands crude. And Canada, as we all know, has been taking the lead from the U.S. in terms of looking at some kind of climate policy that's market-based, that doesn't include any kind of realistic hard caps, and that's loaded with all kinds of giveaways to industry, and this is highly problematic. And so, you know, we were with many, many U.S. indigenous peoples, representatives from Alberta, you know, in Copenhagen to call both Canada and the United States out because, you know, when we're talking about energy policy and we're talking about climate policy, you know, the two countries are inextricably linked.
What would a climate agreement that respected the rights of indigenous people around the world look like?
Well, I think that, you know, part of our 14-point action platform in Copenhagen was calling for some pretty basic things, you know, one of which is that the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, you know, absolutely needs to ratify the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples within the framework, you know, since it's already been ratified by the General Assembly, and that includes, you know, providing you know, a focal point for indigenous peoples within the framework convention, adequate resources for full and meaningful participation. And I think that, you know, any kind of agreement coming out of Copenhagen would respect indigenous peoples' call, you know, for you know, having us really be a part of the negotiations, because up until this point we really haven't. And if you know, if you see what came out of Copenhagen in terms of the political statement, there is only one mention in the subtext related to the World Bank reducing environmental degradation and deforestation text, you know, in the preamble, which is not legally binding in any way. Essentially, it's just taking note that the UN has ratified the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but it's not even in the primary political statement. And so indigenous peoples, along with 99.9% of civil society, was effectively shut out of Copenhagen systematically in the high-level negotiations in the second week. And, you know, one of the things that I observed while I was there was just basically the systematic destruction of any kind of democratic process, coupled with just a complete oppression of civil society, in particular young people, by the police, who a week before the summit started, the federal government of Denmark adopted a policing policy where they were allowed to do preemptive arrests. And so we've seen, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of activists engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience, you know, brutally arrested. At one point, the police invaded a popular neighborhood called Christiana Freetown at the Reclaim Power pre-party where Naomi Klein, you know, was a speaker at, and actually, you know, raided the place with police dogs, tear gas, and pepper spray. And, you know, these were just kids dancing. There was no protest going on there. They were there to celebrate solidarity, climate justice, and the police came in and enacted their preemptive policing policy. And so, I mean, it was just absolutely insane. And, you know, I guess the final observation I'd like to share is that, you know, on the final days when the high-level leaders attended the conference, you know, civil society, NGOs, received 100 passes to divvy up amongst themselves to come into the conference.
You've been back for a few weeks now. In reflecting on what took place in Denmark, what do you think the Indigenous Environmental Network's delegation and other Indigenous climate change activists were able to achieve in Copenhagen?
Well, we had a massive victory. You know, one of the things we were very successful in doing was framing the national debate in the United States around energy policy. The Department of Interior boss, Ken Salazar, showed up in Copenhagen to announce the U.S. administration's energy policy. And, you know, we did a big direct action against the U.S. embassy, and we were featured on NBC Nightly News. You know, 78 million viewers, some of our frontline activists, including Wahala Johns of the Navajo Nation, Black Mesa Water Coalition. They've been fighting Peabody Coal Mining Company for, you know, the last 30 years. They've been having their territory strip mined by this company. And, you know, one of the beautiful things that we very much feel that, you know, our strategy in Copenhagen led to was yesterday's announcement of the reversal of the U.S. administration's decision to provide a life of mine permit to Peabody Coal Mining Company. They reversed that decision. Peabody Coal Mining Company is no longer allowed to mine in Black Mesa, which is a sacred site for the Navajo peoples in Arizona.
Thanks. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. For the listeners, more information is available at ienearth.org. That's ienearth.org. Lots of great video, lots of great multimedia resources available on the website. And thank you so much to Co-op Radio for having us on the show today.
I've been speaking with Clayton Thomas Mueller, and in case you didn't catch that, you can follow the tar sands issue on the Indigenous Environmental Network website at ienearth.org.